Well, we're going to come back to this verse once again and hit it again. There's some things there that I really felt like we needed to hear again and things that I hadn't looked at before, hadn't said. Certainly, I think so often, especially as it concerns me and my preaching, I think sometimes it's kind of like going to one of the buffet places. There's just way too much food to consume it all in one sitting. Well, that's a good thing. So to be able to look at some things that God is speaking to us about. In the summer of 2008, the country, you may remember, the country was shocked to watch on the evening news a disturbing surveillance video showing an elderly man in Hartford, Connecticut, who getting hit by a car and then being ignored by bystanders. Angel Torres, 78, was trying to cross the street when a car plowed into him, sending him flying and leaving him lying crumpled and bleeding in the middle of the street. As Torres lay in the street, people were shocked to see 9 cars drive around this man and keep going. In fact, more than 40 seconds went by before anyone on the sidewalk, there were people almost, you know, not too far away from him standing on the sidewalk, either talking on their cell phones or doing something. But here they saw this man. It took them 40 seconds before someone even stepped off the sidewalk to get a closer look. But no one actually even went over to Torres, his body, to try and help him or to at least even divert traffic. Finally, a police car responding to a different call happened upon the scene, and an ambulance was called. The local police chief, Daryl Roberts, made this really profound statement about the entire incident. He said, "It's obvious that we no longer have a moral compass. It is clear indication of what we have become when you see a man lying in the street, hit by a car, and this just drive around him." When asked, some of the bystanders, when people asked some of the bystanders why they didn't do anything to help this poor guy, they simply said, "Well, you know, we didn't want to get involved. It's not my problem. I don't want to get involved." That kind of seems like the prevailing attitude within a world when it comes to people helping out their neighbors lately, it seems like. Jesus had a different view of things. He teaches us something different. In Matthew 12, 11 and 12, Jesus asks the question. He says, "If any of you has a sheep and it falls into a pit on the Sabbath day, will you not take hold of it and lift it out? How much more valuable is a man than a sheep?" In other words, when faced with the suffering of a dumb, helpless animal, none of us would say, says Jesus, none of you would say, Jesus said, that none of us would think twice of doing whatever it took to alleviate the suffering. You get down in the muck and the mire, we bring ropes and shovels and, we take tools to the site, we call our friends and neighbors to come and help. And it would be the right thing to do. It'd be the kind thing to do. It'd be the gracious thing to do. I even saw on the news not too long ago where the police in some city actually took their time out of their schedule, to actually help a mother duck because all of her ducklings had fallen into a storm drain. And they took time to get all of those ducks out and let her go. I found it remarkable that the police would be willing to do that, but if our first reaction toward a suffering animal, if that's our first reaction to a suffering animal, why isn't it our first reaction when it comes to a suffering human being lying in the middle of the street? Given that human beings are infinitely and intrinsically more valuable than any animal. I wonder what would have been the reaction of the crowd of bystanders in the day that day in Hartford, Connecticut, if who was hit by a car was some, you know, cute, cuddly doggy instead of a 78-year-old man. Would there have been more involvement by the crowd then if it had been a dog? And if so, what does that say about us, about our culture, about our society, that we'd help out a dog before we help out a person? There's something really wrong with that. Our priorities and our values are screwed up. But the Christian, what we see in the world, but the Christian is to be different, right? We're to be different. We're called to be different. And our calling has never been to sit on the sidelines and remain a disconnected, disinterested, and disgruntled lump when human suffering goes on around us. We're called to do something. Now, here's what we need to understand. As believers, we have been and continue to be the recipients of God's amazing grace. Right? As believers, we've been also been entrusted, as Paul was, with the task of testifying to the gospel of God's grace. But the issue is, if we are people who have received grace, then it is our responsibility to become avenues of grace in the lives of other people. This is grace living. Grace living is about allowing grace that we have been given by God to through Christ to flow through us, through the lives of people around us, to become instruments of grace in the life of another. This is the kind of grace that is never more needed, teaches the Apostle Paul in Galatians 6, than when a brother goes off into the ditch spiritually. He teaches us the principle, those who are still on the road have a responsibility to help those who are on the ditch, who are in the ditch. This is what we call the ministry of restoration. And so often we don't see it in the church, going on in the church, and we ought to see it more. Paul writes, he says, if someone is caught in a sin, you who are spiritual are to restore him gently. And so from this we learn that we cannot afford to simply be disinterested bystanders who are content to do nothing when it comes to restoring a broken and hurting brother. Living in love, grace living, demands more than that, than simply to stand and see it happen. We are called to a ministry of restoration. In fact, ladies and gentlemen, even our church motto brings that out, right? To offer, we're all about offering a fresh start to those who need a new beginning. It's all about restoration. It's all about the issue of rescuing the world from itself. And God has given us a responsibility to be involved in that. So our ministry of restoration. Now, last time we looked at some things, and I just want to bring out a couple of things that remind us of a few things and bring out some new things, okay? What we learned last time is that the ministry of restoration to which we are called is begins with involvement. Now, as we remember, Paul has been teaching us to walk in the Spirit, to live Spirit-led lives. But what does that mean, to live a life that's characterized by the Spirit, that's characterized by love and joy and peace and patience and all the other virtues that he mentions. Well, remarkably, it has little to do with some emotional or mystical experience, and more to do with down-to-earth, concrete issues like personal relationships, like your relationship to your brother or sister in Christ. The commentator James Boyce writes this memorable statement in his commentary. He says, it's easy to talk about the fruit of the Spirit while doing very little about it. He says, Christians need to learn that it is in the concrete situations rather than in emotional highs that the reality of the Holy Spirit in our lives is demonstrated. So it's all about the issue. It's not about some emotional thing. It's about really doing what God wants us to do when it really matters. It's one thing to talk about love and joy and patience. It's altogether a different thing to see it being lived out when it really matters, when it really counts, when the rubber meets the road, as it were. Where things like love and patience and kindness really count is when I find my brother in a spiritual ditch. What is a spiritual Christian to do when he or she unexpectedly, as along the road of life, unexpectedly learns that their brother is caught or trapped, is the idea, caught, trapped in some sin? When my brother is in a ditch, what do I do? Well, there are any number of options available to us, right? We can simply gossip about it. We say, well, we wag our heads, we judge our brother, and we say, you know, isn't that a shame? What good is that? What good does that do? That doesn't help the situation. Is that not the definition of being good for nothing? Right? God tells us he wants us to be salt and light in the world. You're going to be salt. There's got to be some taste to you, right? There's got to be something that brings out the difference. So we can either simply gossip about it or do we get all pharisaical about it? You know, we say, well, you know, do we say, well, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men or even like, you know, this guy in the ditch. Isn't that the very thing that Jesus condemned the Pharisees for? He says, they tie up heavy loads and place them on men's back, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. What do we do when we come across my brother in a ditch? Simply gossip. Simply become pharisaical. Oh, I'm so glad I'm not you. What do we do? Or do we simply ignore the situation? Do we say to ourselves, like the disinterested bystanders in Hartford, Connecticut, well, you know, it's not my problem. I don't want to get involved. It's not my problem. It's their problem. They got in the ditch? Let them get out. Again, how could we, in any stretch of the imagination, think that we are at all Spirit-led if that is our attitude? A truly spiritual person cannot and does not simply pass by his wounded brother. Have we forgotten the story of the Good Samaritan? The one who is Spirit-led gets involved. You have to be involved. Now, we learned last week that involvement means really two things. It means, first of all, recognizing that it is our responsibility to do something to help. Notice again the phrase he says, you who are spiritual, in verse 1. You who are spiritual. In this, Paul is identifying who is responsible for doing something in a situation like this. Now, this is a hypothetical situation that he's talking about. Observe that he doesn't address the guy in the ditch. He doesn't address the guy that's trapped in the ditch. He doesn't say to him, okay, buddy, you know that you're in this situation. You got yourself into that situation. Now you get yourself out. No, who is he addressing? You who are spiritual. He's not addressing the guy in the ditch. He's addressing the spiritual people. And he's saying, you know what? Your brother's in a ditch. You need to go and do what you can to help him out. It's your responsibility. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I think I look at this situation and I have to ask myself, you know, I think one of the reasons why Christians don't get involved in the things that they should be involved in, things like helping to restore a broken brother, or even we could talk about the issue of worldwide missions or the issue of evangelism, local evangelism. Why are we not involved? God did not save us to let us sit and not be involved in these things. Why are we sitting around? Don't just, we say, don't just do something, stand there, right? That's our attitude. I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to stand here. Well, what help is that? I remember somebody asked me before I went to Ecuador the first time, they said, why are you going? And I said, I'm going because I feel that it's my responsibility. You know, if we would think about that for just a minute, we would just say to ourselves, you know, we'd be involved a lot more in the things that God is involved in if we looked at those things and said, you know what, it's my responsibility to do something. Whether that's evangelism, whether that's missions, whether that's, kindness or whatever it is that God is calling us to do, if we would own it. A lot of times we don't do the things that we ought to because we're not owning it. It's on me. That's why. And we miss so many opportunities. We miss so many blessings that God could use us for if we would just see ourselves as being the one who is responsible to do something. God did not save you to sit around. He saved you to get involved. Involvement means recognizing that it's my responsibility, but it also the idea of involvement here means that we're going to be involved, if we're going to be involved, that I cannot stay where I am. The word restore is a really pregnant word with meaning. It has all kinds of meanings here. It not only suggests the idea of restoration, we talked about this last time, the idea of restoration in the sense of taking what is broken and restoring it again to usefulness. I think of you buy an old table or an old desk that's been beat up and it's been painted about 100 million times with all different kinds of colors and it's fallen apart. But you buy that thing and you work on it and you strip it down and you sand it and you do all this thing to restore it to usefulness again. That's the idea here. But the idea of the word restore is actually was a medical term to refer to the idea of setting a fractured bone. He says, you see your brother in a ditch? He's got a broken leg spiritually. Go set his bone for him, is really what he's talking about. Restore is an action word. It means I can't stay where I'm at. You know, obviously for a doctor to set a bone, and I've never done it, I've broken a bone before. Couple of them. But obviously, to set a bone, a doctor has to be there. It necessitates personal contact with his patient. He can't simply phone it in from the golf course. Well, here's what you do. He can't do that. He's got to go where the patient is. Then the same is true of us. If I'm going to restore my brother who's in the ditch, I've got to go to him. I can't wait for him to come to me. I got to go to him. I got to go where he is. Why? Because the principle is that love necessitates action. It requires action. You got to do something. And that means I can't stay where I'm at. Now, this ministry of restoration is not just the idea of involvement here, because Paul not just tells us what we need to do, but he's going to tell us how to do it. And I want you to notice here that this ministry of restoration, not just that it begins with involvement, but that it requires gentleness. Notice in verse 1 he says, "You who are spiritual should restore your brother." He says, but do it gently. Gently. So he's not just telling us what to do, he's telling us how to do it. Is your brother in a ditch, he says. Are you walking in the Spirit? Okay? You should take the initiative to restore your brother. But do it gently. Why gently? Well, you know what? Understand that there's something far more devastating, destructive than inaction. There's something worse than simply being content to be a disinterested bystander when your brother is lying in the ditch, spiritually broken and bleeding. And what is that? Spiritual brutality. There's something worse than turning a blind eye to the sufferings of others. There's something worse than non-involvement, and that's trying to spiritually restore someone in a harsh and heartless way. And I've seen this happen in churches. I've watched Christians fillet one another with their own words. And I'm sure that everything that they were saying was true. I'm sure that they had good reason to be upset. Perhaps they were even defending a biblical position. But the way they went about it, what they said and how they said it, what they did and how they did it, absolutely devastating and destructive in its outcome. And in the end, what you saw was nothing that resembled Christ or Christian grace. Robert Fulghum wrote a book in the 1980s called All I Really Need to Know, I Learned in Kindergarten. I like that title. In it, he wrote, he says, All I really need to know about how to live and what to do and how to be, I learned in kindergarten. Share everything, play fair, and don't hit people. Say you're sorry when you hit somebody. Okay. And he goes on and he says, you know, our world would be a better place if everybody, including the leaders of our governments, lived by these basic principles. Share everything, play fair, and don't hit people. It's a very simple, you know, philosophy. I agree with it. And you know what? I think our churches would be a lot better too if we followed those things, right? Share everything. Play fair. Don't hit people. What is gentleness? And why is it needed in this ministry of restoring broken people? If our church is to be about the issue of restoring broken people, not just the issue of Christians, but even non-Christians that come into our midst, why is gentleness so important? Well, first of all, let's define what gentleness is first. Gentleness is really an amazing quality. And it's sad in the sense because it seems like it's not really honored in our culture today, especially as it relates to men, right? In our culture, we extol those supposed virtues of the action hero. You know, the guy with rippling pectorals who's got all kinds of martial art ability. You know, the Steven Seagal kind of type. The Jean-Claude Van Damme type of men who rushes in where angels fear to tread and takes care of business. Comes in like a charging rhino and just takes care of business. And you watch what our culture lauds. I mean, I doubt you're going to have a blockbuster where an Arnold Schwarzenegger is just going to talk about love and flowers. I mean, people, oh, that's boring. I'm waiting for the video game that doesn't just kill zombies, but tries to lead them to Jesus. Say, I'm not going to listen. I'm not going to watch those video games. I mean, you're not going to see them. Don't worry about it. You're not going to see them. We don't honor gentleness in our culture. As a consequence, we tend to think of gentleness as weakness. We tend to think that a gentle man is some milquetoast, woman-whipped individual who can't stand up for himself. That's not gentleness. But what I want you to see is that gentleness is, in fact, one of the greatest strengths there is, because it takes a real man to be gentle. For what makes gentleness such an amazing character quality is the fact that gentleness, get this, is a composite virtue. What do I mean by that? What I mean is that gentleness is a virtue that is a combination of several other virtues. I mean, take the color purple, for example. I love the color purple. It's my favorite color. Anybody have a favorite color purple? A few of you got purple on. Do you know what purple is? Purple is the combination of red and blue, right? Red and blue make purple. In the same way, gentleness is a combination of several separate different virtues. One is patience. A truly gentle person is a patient person. Someone who is not forceful even when they have reason to be. They endure with a sweet reasonableness even when provoked. Gentleness is treating a wounded person with soft hands. And you can't do that unless you're patient. I got a lot of work ahead of me because I am not by nature a patient person. Patience. Humility. Gentleness is a combination of patience and humility. Humility is a critical component in gentleness because prideful people normally don't lower themselves to become involved in helping somebody in a ditch. The truly prideful people are like the people in Jesus' story, the Good Samaritan. They look at the guy and they walk along the other side. I'm too important. I've got things to do. Don't you realize who I am? Those kinds of people do not demonstrate gentleness. There's a story told of a corporal at Valley Forge who was directing three men as they were trying to lift a log into place. It was too heavy, but the corporal continued to command them to pick it up. Come on, men, lift, lift! Finally, a guy came by in a big trench coat and said, well, why don't you help him out? He looked at the guy and said, hey, I'm the corporal, dude. The man got off his horse and helped the guy, those three guys. Went into place very easily. That man was General Washington, Supreme Commander of the Continental Army. Listen, people, it's guaranteed when you're not humble, you're not gentle. So if you're going to restore a brother, you can't go in there with all pride and say, you know, thinking that you're all that and saying to yourself, man, I'm just so glad I'm not you. And you just get it together, what's wrong with you kind of thing. No, no. I come in there with gentleness and humility and patience, kindness. Humility is a combination of patience, humility, and kindness. Obviously, kindness is the virtue of demonstrating a restraint of yourself from giving people what you think they deserve.